Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today is an important day. Cosmotheist Books has just released a new edition of a most important book, Revelo Pendleton Oliver's The Origins of Christianity. This book is available now at cosmotheistchurch.org. That's cosmotheistchurch, all one word, .org. This new edition of this book corrects serious errors and omissions of all previous editions. And insofar as my powers are able to make it, it is exactly as the author intended. As I said in my foreword to the book, our belief systems, such as religions, have no actual existence except as chemical and electrical activity in our brains. They have no more reality than do dreams. For something so insubstantial, however, they have profound effects upon our lives and upon the race and civilization to which we belong. Religions produce not only cultural artifacts, such as temples to Athena or Mithras or Jesus, holy books, music, and the like. They also often constitute a controlling influence over what men think, and therefore also over what men do, thus defining the structure of our laws and punishments, our wars and crusades, our standards of sexual behavior, and 1,000 other things. For all their constant mutations, fantastic improbabilities, and mutually exclusive claims of infallibility, religions remain a powerful factor in determining who shall live and who shall die, and who shall be allowed power and wealth, and who shall be condemned to impotence and penury. So, religions must be taken very seriously, even by, perhaps especially by, those who find it impossible to believe in them. Thus, the study and understanding of the religion currently dominant among members of our race, Christianity, is of the utmost importance. Dr. Revelo Pendleton Oliver, 1908 to 1994, one of the leading classicists, philologists, and scholars of the 20th century, was uniquely qualified to write on such matters. Dr. Oliver made a special study of religions, ancient and modern, writing often on the subject both for scholarly journals and for the public. And his personal library contained the greatest collection of books on religion that I have seen outside of a large university library. This volume, Dr. Oliver's last major work, was begun in 1980, around the time that his earlier books, America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, and The Jewish Strategy, were being finished. The Origins of Christianity was undergoing final revisions, for example, the removal of phraseology that had become outdated upon the fall of the Soviet Union, and the addition of a few new amplifications of certain points in the text at the time of his death. Dr. Oliver regarded this book as his most important work. In my opinion, no higher recommendation is possible. Now let us sample using artificial intelligence for the good purpose of presenting Revelo Oliver's writings in his own voice. The first small section here of The Origins of Christianity. Listen.
Of the many problems that confront us today, none is more vexing than that of the relation of Christianity to Western civilization. None, certainly, causes more acrimonious controversy and internecine hostility between the members of the race which created that civilization. None more thoroughly counteracts their common interest in its preservation and renders them impotent and helpless. And that is not remarkable. What is in question is the essential nature of our civilization. And if there's no agreement about that, there can be no effective agreement on other questions. Around 1910, Georges Matisse, in Les Ruines de l'Idée de Dieu, predicted that by 1960, at the very latest, the only churches left in the civilized world would be the ones that were preserved as museum pieces for their architectural beauty or historical associations. The scientific and historical knowledge accumulated by our race had rendered belief in supernatural beings impossible for cultivated men. And universal education would speedily destroy the credulity of the masses. Quote, "We have climbed out of the dead end of the dungeon into which Christianity cast us. The man of today walks in the open air and the daylight. He has won confidence in himself." End quote. In 1980, especially in the United States, there was a massive upsurge of Christianity. In November, one of America's many bawling evangelists, Oral Roberts, had an interview with Jesus and took the opportunity to observe that Jesus is 900 feet tall. That datum so impressed his followers that within 2 weeks, it is said, they supplied him with an extra $5 million to supplement the $45 million they give him annually. A little earlier, another holy man, Don Stewart, reportedly made the big time in evangelism, that is, an annual take of more than $10 million, by distributing to his votaries snippets of his underwear, which true believers put under their pillows, since the bits of cloth that had been in contact with his flesh had absorbed the manna of his holiness. And in the quadrennial popularity contest to determine which actor was to have the star role in the White House, all three of the presidential candidates deemed it expedient to announce that they had got Jesus and been born again. More significantly, in both England and the United States, a considerable number of men who have received enough technical training to be called scientists have been hired or inspired to prove the authenticity of the Holy Shroud of Turin by scientific proof that the coarse cloth was discolored by supernatural means, the manna of divinity. Some of these scientists, it is true, claim that the vague picture was formed on the fabric because the body of the deceased god was highly radioactive and emitted radiation of an intensity comparable to that produced by the explosion of the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. But obviously only a very supernatural force could have charged the cells of an organic body with such enormous and deadly energy. In many American colleges, professors of reputable academic subjects are teaching courses to demonstrate that human beings cannot be the product of the biological process of evolution, but must have been specially designed and manufactured by a god in a way that they more or less explicitly identify with the well-known account of the descent of mankind from Adam and his spare rib. The Divinity School of Emory University, founded in 1836, offers, for the edification of Methodist ministers, a graduate seminar in the theology of America's most distinguished automobile thief and rapist, a black preacher named King, and presumably for such exemplary Christianity, was rewarded with a gift of $100 million the largest private benefaction on record. The United States has always been noted for the multiplicity and fanaticism of its Christian sects, but on a much smaller scale, a Christian outreach, to use the evangelical term, for souls and funds may be observed in several countries of Europe, even including, it is said, some in Soviet territory. And one wonders whether a survey in England today would maintain the statistics that permitted Professor A.N. Whitehead to conclude in 1942 that far less than one-fifth of the population are in any sense Christians today. I hear that the fraction would have to be significantly increased, and that Roman Catholicism, more than other sects, is constantly attracting a significant number of converts. But the number of persons who attend churches or profess to believe someone of the numerous Christian doctrines is relatively unimportant. The domestic and foreign policies of all the nations of the Western world are based on ideas that their populations as a whole take for granted and accept without reflection or consideration. Ideas which are obviously, though sometimes not explicitly, derived from Christian theology and are, so to speak, a residue of the ages when our race was, not inaccurately, called Christendom. Matisse was egregiously wrong. His spectacular error, however, was a projection logically made from the evidence available to him in 1910, when he concluded that, quote, "The white race has conquered the whole world and slain the dragon of superstition, and the race had to do it. If the human mind had been incapable of that achievement, the most difficult of all its achievements, it would have been doomed. Intellect would have ended in failure on this planet. It was a question of the life or death of intelligence. The indisputable proof of the innately superior power of the European mind today is atheism." End quote. Matisse, of course, did not foresee the catastrophe of 1914. Or sense the subterranean and occult forces that were secretly in operation, even in 1910, to precipitate not just another European war to alter the balance of power on the continent, but a war that those forces converted into a universal disaster, even more destructive of rationality than of property and life, which may prove to have been the beginning of the end for our civilization and race. The question that Matisse so clearly posed, therefore, remains not altered by the calamities he could not foresee, but instead now made even more vital and urgent. The question is obviously, perhaps fatally, divisive, but it cannot be evaded or ignored. The question is one to which even reticence is an answer, and hypocrisy is demoralizing. I have therefore undertaken the exacting and almost impossible task of presenting in these pages an objective and dispassionate summary of the problem, condensing into a few pages what would more properly be the substance of several volumes, themselves compendious. I have necessarily refrained from debating side issues and from straying into scholarly controversies. I have tried to limit myself to skeletal essentials of what may with confidence be regarded as established fact and logical inference therefrom, and I assume that I need not tell intelligent readers that the subject is one on which it is flatly impossible to make any statement whatsoever that is not contradicted somewhere in the horrendous tonnage of printed paper on the shelves of even a mediocre library. To view our problem clearly, we must begin with its beginnings and indicate as summarily as possible its prehistoric origins, limiting ourselves to matters directly relevant to our own race, with which alone we need have a rational concern. And since Indo-European is best reserved for use as a linguistic term, and such words as Nordic and Celtic are too restrictive as designations of variations within our species, we shall use the only available word in general use that designates our race as a whole, although the Jews have forbidden us to use it. The word Aryan, furthermore, has the advantage that it is not a geographic term, and while some may think it immodest to describe ourselves as Arya, noble, that word does indicate a range of moral concepts for which our race seems to have instinctively a peculiar and characteristic respect, which differentiates it from other races as sharply as do its physical traits.
You have been listening to an excerpt from the most important new publication of this year, the new edition of Dr. Revelo P. Oliver's The Origins of Christianity, now available at cosmotheistchurch.org.